Thank you. We're all aware of the old proverb, he who laughs last laughs best. And today the final laugh, or at least the final word, belongs to Bruce Bartlett, who's a senior fellow of the National Center for Policy Analysis and a syndicated columnist with Creator Syndicate. He previously held positions at the Alexis de Tocqueville Institution, the Cato Institute, and the Heritage Foundation. From 1988 to 1993, he served as Deputy Assistant Secretary for Economic Policy, Policy Analysis, in the U.S. Treasury Department, as well as previously having served in a number of congressional posts. Mr. Bartlett earned his B.A. at Rutgers and his M.A. at Georgetown University, and is the author of The Supply Side Revolution and Reaganomics, The Supply Side Economics in Action, as well as numerous articles in the Wall Street Journal, New York Times, Fortune, The Public Interest, the National Tax Journal, and other publications. So, Mr. Bartlett.
All this talk about a third way reminds me of the old story about the difference between communism and capitalism. Under capitalism, it's dog eat dog. Under communism, of course, it's exactly the reverse. I want to take a step back for a moment and talk a little bit about Germany and the economic recovery after World War II, because I think there are some lessons here that are important both for the topic of this conference and this panel in particular. Now, we really need to start in the 19th century to a certain extent to understand the context in which people like Röpke and Erhard and Eucken were functioning when they were talking about the social market economy in the 1940s and 50s. In Germany, as you recall, up until the middle of the century, it was really very much of a loose confederation of little principalities, of which the largest and most powerful, of course, was Prussia. And the process of unification of Germany came about with the creation of the customs union, the Zollverein, in the early part of the century, that grew out very much out of the work of an economist named Frederick List. List is notable among economists as being probably the only economist of any repute who was basically a protectionist. That is, he believed that Germany, greater Germany in a sense, should surround itself with barriers to trade to outside countries. But he was very, very adamant, and this is very important, that all barriers to trade within Germany be utterly abolished. And this was a very serious problem. There were numerous tariffs and toll barriers to trade within Germany that prevented the creation of a modern state. And so the tradition in Germany intellectually was very much along the lines of protectionism. And this was added to by there was a strong view in support of mercantilism. Gustav Schmaler was probably the leading economist of the late 19th century, very much of a mercantilist in the sense that he wanted to have a strong state. And part of what led to creation of a strong state was some element of trade autarky. Now, this is very important because in the late 1870s or so, Bismarck turned very much away from what limited amount of free trade there was, and it really became very much official German policy for a long time thereafterwards to have very large trade barriers. Now, the consequence of this that I'm leading up to is that you had a problem with cartels in Germany. When you have no foreign competition, you've eliminated a very, very strong element of competition from the domestic market. And this problem was exacerbated by the fact that in Germany, almost unique among countries that I'm aware of, cartels were legal. You could legally go, you know, Microsoft could go to, Intel or somebody and set up a cartel arrangement and draw up a contract just as if this was a normal business dealing. And if one of the partners in this cartel decided to cheat and sell below market prices or some such thing, you could haul them into court and they could be enjoined. So you had a problem of in which monopolies and cartels were a very, very serious problem in Germany. Secondly, because of the tradition from Schmaler and List, and because of the political context, you never really had the development of any kind of true liberalism in the European sense in Germany. There was simply no tradition at all of thinking about the free market in any context whatsoever. There simply was, they had no experience with it. There was no thought related to it. It's not unimportant that that almost all of the important German-speaking economists that we know of are all from Austria. They're not German. The Eucken and Röpke really stand out as very distinctive, precisely because there were so few of them. Now, they in the Weimar period started to think about how to create a genuine German liberal tradition, at least insofar as the economy was concerned. And they were very much hampered by this lack of any kind of tradition, and by the fact that you had this cartel situation that gave a very bad name to the whole idea of being sort of pro-business. It was very pejorative. Furthermore, the leading leftist party, the SPD, had a very heavy Marxist orientation. Marxism was very strong in Germany. And the whole notion of what people thought about when they thought about economic liberalism or laissez-faire or the free market was very much a Marxist caricature. That is, this notion of, you know, cutthroat competition and this sort of stuff was viewed as very, very distasteful. And so I think that it's very important to think about the social market economy in this context, that they were very concerned about the presentation of liberal ideas in a way that was politically palatable. And that's why this constant emphasis on the social side was very critical to the selling of really what was just plain free market economics. I disagree somewhat with some of the earlier speakers who talked about the idea that the social market economy was some kind of genuine sort of third way. I don't think it really was a third way at all. I think it was just a way of packaging and selling the free market in a way that was acceptable in a country in which there was great hostility and no tradition of thinking about these issues in the way that we do in the West. Now, I want to get right away up to Erhard, because I think Erhard is really one of the most exceptional people in the history of the world, quite frankly. And it's important to know that although Erhard was very much an ally and to a certain extent a student of people such as Eucken and Röpke, he was really not an academic. He never actually studied with any of them. He was not part of any kind of school, so to speak. His main professor actually was a sociologist named Franz Oppenheimer, who wrote a very interesting book about the state that had very strong Georgist overtones to it. But when Erhard got out of university, his main work was in business. I don't think he ever actually held a university position. He worked for a business association that was very much involved in consumer research for marketing purposes. He was a business economist, so to speak. And I think this is very important in terms of his the things that he did in the future, because he was left out of it. Didn't have to deal with the kind of difficulties that you had in academia then as now, where it's it can be an extremely oppressive situation for those whose views are not part of the dominant mainstream, which of course then as now is very much on the left. Now, Erhard was working for this consumer research firm, association, all during the Nazi years, and pretty much kept his nose to the grindstone and kept out of trouble. But he did stay in Germany throughout the whole Nazi period. But as the war started to wind to an end, in 1943, 1944, both he and other people, such as Eucken, who also stayed in Germany during the war, the handwriting was on the wall. They knew something was going to happen and fairly soon, and they wanted to, they were very much anxious to plan for the transition to a post-war economy in a situation which they knew Germany would be occupied by Western powers. And they thought this was a golden opportunity to try to set some things right that had been wrong in the German economy for a long time, in particular this problem of cartels. They were very. This was an extremely important part of the whole social market economy. I disagree a little bit with Dr. Borman earlier, who said that Earhart or Roepke would have favored a U.S.-style antitrust policy, and this is not exactly right. What they simply wanted to do was to get rid of the legal standing the cartels had, so that market forces could be brought to bear on the cartel situation. Now, in I believe it was 1943, Eucken first started to draft a plan for the post-war recovery that very much established the outlines of what we came to call the German economic miracle. And on his own, Earhart was thinking along the same lines. Now, when the American forces, the French, British, Russian forces occupied Germany in 1945. Earhart was rather fortunate, I think, to have been in the American zone of occupation, and because he was a known economist who had not been affiliated with the Nazis, through a fortunate set of circumstances, he came to the attention of the American authorities, in particular General Lucius Clay, to be an advisor in terms of some of the economic policies that the occupying forces knew that they had to undertake. And he became the economics minister of the American zone, which was mainly the Bavaria. And he first began implementing or starting to try to implement some of his policies. He ran into political difficulties, as he often did, and lost his position, but remained active in politics and in economic affairs. And as we now know, in 1948, he once again became economics minister, this time of the buy zone. In 1946, the British and the Americans joined their two zones together for administrative purposes, and they began to plan the economic recovery. Now, the main problem that existed at that time was one of repressed inflation. Roepke wrote about this a great deal. It's the phenomenon that you get where you have rampant money supply growth, very inflationary money supply growth, combined with economic price controls, so that the visible effects of the inflationary monetary policy are not visible. But they do have certain other effects. The money is there. It does slosh around. It has certain economic effects, one of which is that you almost inevitably run into shortages. Therefore, you have to have rationing. What you found is that people worked just enough to get the money they needed to be able to buy what few things were available for rationing purposes, and they spent all the rest of their time working for themselves, either in some sort of barter transactions or growing food on a private plot, or foraging in the countryside, which was a very common activity. Businesses had exactly the problem that Richard talked about. They couldn't transact financial relationships. They had to spend almost all their time bartering. Furthermore, the prospect of that the controls would be lifted someday led to vast amounts of hoarding. And I don't remember exact figures. I think in 1947, it was estimated that German businesses, which actually came out of the war in relatively good shape, had something like a year's supply of inventories on hand, plus another year's supply of supplies for producing their goods or whatever products that they were producing. So you had virtually no products coming into the market. Nobody wanted to sell at controlled prices, and plus they wanted to be able to take advantage of any increase in prices that would be allowed at some point when the controls were lifted. And this created a very paralyzing problem for the whole economy. Nobody was working, nobody was producing, and there was simply nothing available. And at this point, this is where Earhart's insight in terms of consumer goods was extremely important, because he understood, unlike most economists in Germany at that time, they all had, as many economists in this country do, a focus on big business industry. The whole idea was, how do we build up the steel industry? How do we build up the auto industry, big sorts of businesses? And the consumer goods sector always gets sort of short shrift. This was definitely the case in the old Soviet Union. They just never produced anything that anybody actually wanted or needed. But this is very important in terms of motivation for work. Earhart's insight is that people don't work for money. They work for what money will buy. And if there's nothing to buy, people won't work no matter what you pay them. And so he had a very strong interest in getting the consumer goods sector going as quickly as possible. And at the same time, he needed to make money worth something, and he needed to be able to get rid of the price controls. And working with General Clay, they secretly printed a great deal of new currency in the United States. It was shipped over to Germany and distributed. And as most people know, on the night of, I believe, June 20th, 1948, they did a currency reform in which the old Reichsmark was withdrawn from circulation, replaced by the Deutsche Mark at a 1-for-10 ratio. Now, to most economists and myself, for many years, I didn't understand what the point of all this was. I mean, what difference does it make what you call the money? What's the purpose? Well, the purpose was that the price level, the real price level, that is to say the black market price level, had gone up about 10 times. And so you had the control prices were roughly a tenth of what the free market price would be. Now, if you simply eliminated price controls, you'd have overnight a massive inflation. Prices would all rise by about 10 times. And given Germany's history with the hyperinflation during the 1920s, this was considered to be something that was just absolutely unpalatable politically. So the virtue of the 10-for-1 exchange of currency was that the new prices in terms of Deutsche Marks were approximately equal now to the controlled prices. So you could now eliminate the price controls and essentially have no visible change in the price level. And this was the great virtue of it. Now, of course, the other great thing that Earhart did that everybody knows about is that he got rid of all the price controls at the same time. And there's a famous story that he told General Clay or he was under orders that he said, you need to get my permission to change any prices, but Earhart figured out that he didn't need anybody's permission to simply get rid of them. So it was a bit of a loophole, but Clay knew exactly what Earhart was doing, and they were working very much together, and so there was a lot of winking and nodding going on. Now, a lot of people you read a lot of things where people talk about the brilliance of the currency reform and this sort of thing, but the really important thing was the elimination of the price controls, and the evidence of this is shown very clearly by the fact that in the French zone, they did the currency reform, but they didn't eliminate the price controls. And subsequently, the British and the buy zone, the British American zones, took off economically, while the French and, of course, the Russian zones lagged far behind. Now, I want to mention something here about Röpke that I think is rather is sort of a sideline, but it's rather interesting, I think. In the whole after the Potsdam Conference, the assumption was that the Germany would become reunified at some point. But of course, we know that the Russians were now more so than of course they knew then were going to be a very severe obstacle to this. And it was Röpke who was the first one to suggest in a book called The German Question, published in 1945, that the western zones of Germany really ought to look upon this Russian problem not as an obstacle, but as an advantage, because Röpke was very much concerned about the influence that the Prussians had over Germany as a whole, and he saw that by isolating the eastern part, the Prussian part of Germany, away from the western part, was actually an advantage. You got rid of this Prussian influence behind the Iron Curtain. So he said. So he was the first one really to suggest that the western part of Germany go it alone and not continue to hold out and press forward for reunification at all cost, because the cost would have been too high if you had to do it on Russian terms, of course. And I think that's a very brilliant political insight, I think. I want to mention something also about the Mont Pelerin Society, because it was very important in my reading of the what Earhart was doing, because there were so few free market economists around at that time. They were extremely isolated, and there was very little communication, surprisingly little. I read somewhere that that Hayek's book, The Road to Serfdom, was actually banned throughout most of Germany. There was heavy censorship by the Allies. And one of the few means of communication they had was a sort of something similar to what you had in the old Soviet Union, where they had what they call the Samizdat or something like that, the sort of privately circulated newsletters and things. And they used to get copies of newspaper articles that Röpke wrote in Swiss papers, and they would pass them around to each other. And Röpke's wife, I don't know very many of you know this, translated The Road to Serfdom into German. And so these few people really did an enormous amount, and a lot of it was coordinated at the Montpellier meeting, where for the first time, this was the first opportunity some Germans had been allowed out of the country in a very, very long time, and had not seen many of these their colleagues, their friends, other people whose works they may have been familiar with but didn't know personally. And I think it gave them an enormous amount of help in terms of pushing forward with what they did. I'm about at the end here, I guess. I think I'll just stop. Yeah, I'm just going to stop. Bye.